This is Girl on the River, the podcast. Whole crew, come forward to row. Hello and welcome back to Girl on the River, the podcast for episode 18 and the last episode of season one. As I said last week, I'm taking a few weeks away from the podcast to reset and get organised and to allow you to catch up on any episodes you've missed. If you include the bite-sized mini-episodes, which I don't include in the episode count, there are actually 21 for you to choose from, ranging from interviews with Olympic legends, adventurers, and experts on different aspects of physical and mental health, to a passionate discussion addressing the important question, if you had to select an 8 out of biscuits, what would they be and in what order? You can find them all on my website, girlontheriver.com, or on whatever podcast app you use. Just search for Girl on the River. And you can even ask Alexa or Google Assistant to find a particular episode for you. Thank you, as always, for your lovely messages and comments. It honestly means the world to me to hear what you have to say. And do keep the suggestions coming in for future guests, which brings me to this week. This week's guests are here at the suggestion, well, actually the insistence of the wonderful Di Binley. And she has been such a supporter of mine over the years that there was no way I was going to let her down. And I have to say, it was also an absolutely cracking suggestion. So this Sunday, the 4th of April, is Boat Race Day, and it's a particularly historic one for several reasons. First of all, it's not taking place on the River Thames as it usually does, but instead in the beautiful city of Ely on the Great Ouse over a slightly shortened course, and it will be the first time it's been held there since 1944. It will be a COVID secure event, so there won't be any spectators, but it will be covered fulsomely on the BBC with the usual commentary and no doubt with some whizzy graphics. Equally exciting, for the first time in the race's history, it will have women umpires for both the men's and the women's races. And I am absolutely delighted to have as my guests none other than those umpires, Sarah Winkless MBE, who is umpiring the men's race, and Judith Packer, who is umpiring the women's race. So here they are. Well, Sarah and Judith, a very, very warm welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patricia. It's really lovely to be here.
Well, it's great to have you both in the same room, as it were, over Zoom. And we have so much to talk about. But what I'd like to do is start by getting each of you just to tell me a little bit about your background, how you came into rowing and how you came to be umpiring at this level. So, Sarah, do you want to kick off?
Yeah, really happy to, thank you. So I never intended to be a rower, and I probably shouldn't say that on this podcast because, of course, it's full of rowing fans. But my father was a rower, my stepfather was a rower, and I just wanted to do something a bit different. You want to forge your own way, I think, as a teenager. And, you know, I fought against it. I went to Cambridge as a discus thrower, as a netball player, and I got into a boat and got the bug, and I couldn't deny, I guess, my physiology. And it was at Fitzwilliam College that I first properly started to row. They were really, really welcoming to me. They put me in a reasonably experienced boat so I could learn quickly. I think I already had that athletic ability. They could see that, the morphology and the willingness to learn once I got out my own way. So they were brilliant.
So did you start with sweep?
I sort of started a number five in an eight, yeah. And my first race was Fairburns, and I thought I was going to die because as a discus thrower, you have a nice rest the day before and you do a bit of stretching and eat some food and make sure that, you know, you are ready for a ballistic 1 second movement six times. It was, you know, as a netball player, I played at either end of the court. So I got to have rests often during matches, if that's the way you want to look at it. And then suddenly I was testing my bravery and my physiology in a row and my technique. And I it looks so easy when it's done well. And I've been lucky enough to watch people do rowing brilliantly. So I had this idea that it was going to be really easy. Of course, I tried to do it and I had the skills to learn, and it was really, really hard. So I had to learn to be brave enough. I had to learn the technique, and I had to learn the language as well, actually, because despite having watched a lot of rowing, I hadn't really listened to understand the nuances, the language of the racing. So a year at Fitzwilliam, loved it, got the bug, did something they call Dev Squad at Cambridge, which got me to the Nat Champs in an age again. And the next year, I found myself in the middle of the Blue Boat at Henley, unable to breathe, because I was absolutely terrified for the same reasons. I was going to let my crew down. I wouldn't be brave enough. My technique wouldn't hold out. But having done that race and we were victorious on that day, it was the best I'd ever felt. I'd been so, so scared. And I've got lifelong friends who I still work with, and actually Siobhan Cassidy, who stroked that race, she is fully, fully involved in what we're doing at Ely. So made lifelong friends through that event, kept the bug 2 more years, present in my final year, and left thinking, what else can I do in this sport? And was lucky enough to go to Longridge, join the women's rowing squad there. Not a quick success. It took me 6-7 years to get onto the podium at World Championships. It was my first podium medal was at the Olympic Games in Athens, a long, long time after that. And then followed that up with a couple of World Championship golds. And then when I retired, I definitely wanted to put something back into sport and this sport. And a little bit later on, I became an umpire, and that allowed me to be a boat race umpire.
So your boat race umpiring, just run us through what you've done.
Sorry, I'm going to have to let the dog out.
Yes, of course. Go ahead. Really,
this is live. Sorry. Hello, do you want to get out?
This is like this morning with Matthew Pinsent's dog and the rabbit.
But you know, Patricia, this is the honesty about this current year that we're living in, isn't it? This pandemic where people have let each other into our living rooms. I've been on business meetings where male colleagues had their little ones at home. And actually, there's a real honesty about that, I think. So,
yeah.
Well, never worked with female animals, my animal.
Well, this morning, Judith and I were both on the Zoom Ergos where Matthew Pinsent's dog had caught a baby rabbit. And there's this moment where he went outside and you could hear him obviously talking to his wife going, yeah, I'll deal with it in a minute. And you can imagine the anguish going on out there. And we're all going.
That is a beautiful dog. It's helped with the weigh-in at the boat race a couple of times.
Oh. Well, it's in disgrace today. So. So tell us a little bit about your umpiring at the boat race, what you've done so far and what the significance of last year was going to be.
Yes. So boat race umpiring was the reason why I became an umpire. They were looking to bring the women onto the Tideway. They realised they'd need some women umpires, and I was asked whether I would do it. And at the time, I was really overstretched. I was trying to forge a new career. I didn't know that I had the time, and I wanted to stay fit as an athlete. So umpiring takes up a lot of time. We'll talk about that later, but it was something that I didn't know that I had the time for. But then I kind of thought about the opportunity, and it felt I could feel my heart rate going up. I could, and I thought, are you saying no because you haven't got time? Or are you saying no because actually you're scared or excited at this opportunity? And once I thought about that, I kind of had to explore that thought, and I realized that it was something that was a real opportunity. It was actually very exciting to be part of this race in a different way. And so I started to try and understand what I needed to do to become the best boat race umpire I wanted to be. And that meant becoming a British rowing umpire. And then I started to shadow the men who were on the umpires panel. Judith and I started to do that work and really understand the racing. And to date, on that first time that the women came onto the Tideway, I actually umpired the Blondie Osiris race. It was on the day before. It was on the Friday. And we ran it from no state boats with no river closure. But we got those women able to do that race. I've also umpired the Goldieitis race and the women's blue boat. So this one will be my full highest.
Fantastic. And have you ever raced on the Tideway yourself as a rower? Because obviously when you were doing the boat race in Cambridge, that would have been at Henley, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so actually interesting, when we were training for the Henley races, we would do match races very much like the men do on the Tideway. One of my interestingly triggered moments as an umpire, and I didn't expect to happen, was when I was in the same bit of the river I had been as an athlete, and there was a real clash moment, and I got really triggered because I was triggered that day myself. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I didn't realise I'm going to have to manage myself in that way potentially. So I'd done fixtures as we see the men and women doing fixture on the Tideway. Of course, I'd also raced the heads, which are the other way round. But actually, when you're racing, that's the view you see as an umpire rather than as a rower. So I knew the Tideway well, and I'd trained out of Hammersmith in my single for some months. So had used it as an athlete, but not in the boat race form, the Putney, the championship course that we now see the women do.
And Judith, tell us a little bit about how you've come to be here.
Well, I nothing like Sarah. So I am not from a sporty family, and I'm not really the physique that you would think would be an Olympic athlete. But I managed to get into Oxford, St. Peter's College, to study engineering in 1983. Actually, I deferred a year to do a year in industry, spend a year in a gas turbine factory in Lincoln, would you believe? And so I went up to Oxford thinking, okay, what am I going to do at university? And Freshers Week, so many different things, so many different opportunities. And literally it was the spur of the moment, having spoken to various different groups and remembering probably black and white pictures of the boat race, thinking, actually, you know what, I'll have a go at this rowing thing. Do they take women? So off I went down, and I think in those days, 1983, there was a bit of paper on the lodge notice board, and you just signed up, and then you turn up down the river. So at St. Peter's College, we shared OUBC boathouse. So I think we had one boat or two boats, wooden, Macon blades. We had to share everything. And I think it was a few years since they'd actually had a women's eight. So a volunteer coach got this rabble together, didn't really have any proper kit. So this rabble together and got us out in a bank tub with blades with holes in it, first of all. You know, somehow there's this odd thing that happens where people sort of gel and come together, and you're all studying different subjects, and some people have to get back for lectures or get back for labs, and something happens. It's a mysterious thing. But these volunteer coaches give their time and energy to give you the rudiments of rowing. And then at Oxford, just like Cambridge, you start with the bumps. And so the real key is to go off fast, try not to get catapulted out of the boat, and then bump, literally bump the next one on. So the key was sprint. Unfortunately, most of the times, we managed to get almost there to the end at the head of the river and either got bumped, but we did bump a few people. So that's where my passion for rowing was born, very humbly on the banks at Oxford. And then I actually had to give up rowing to study. Back in those days, I didn't really understand the value of sport. I wasn't from a sporty family, so there was no real value attached there to it. But something had been planted in me. And so when I started work post-university, a colleague at work had heard this woman in the CAD department had done rowing at Oxford. And I'm sure he thought I was better than I really was. But they took me down to Newark. And so we traveled 30 minutes a day, mostly men there. And they just got me out in a boat, and they taught me to single scull. And I guess that's where I just discovered a wider breadth of rowing. And then they persuaded me to have a race. And then I think the big moment was when we were doing a lightweight Coxless Four, and our coach took us down to Women's Henley. And I discovered that, A, there were lots more women that rowed. So that was a real revelation. And trying to steer from stroke the Coxus 4. So that was very intense. That's when the vision or the passion makes you realise there's more people do this thing. You're not an oddity. And there's more than just an eight. There's lots of different types of running. So I guess that's where it really, I got the bug, really, big time. And then with work, had to drop it a few times, but somehow it's kept with me all this time.
And you've moved into umpiring in quite a considerable way. You're a FISA umpire, so big time.
Yeah, so having sort of lost quite a lot of races, when you realise you're on the start line against people half your age, or could be your children, you realise, actually, I love this thing called rowing, but want to keep involved, and as Sarah said, want to give back. And so became a British rowing umpire in 2001, actually failed it the first time. And then a group of us helped out to put on the World Rowing Cup in Dorney in 2005 and the World Champs in 2006. And again, never knew there was international rowing. And then after that, a few of the visiting overseas umpires said, oh, have you had a thought of doing international umpiring? And there was a few of us that went on to do that. And FISA is now called World Rowing. And actually, it's just opened up such a big thing. Rowing is around the world and is something that anybody can do.
Do you think it's going to come out from behind that sort of other sports category? Do you think it can break into the mainstream?
Well, rowing is evolving. You know, next year we've got, in the UK, we've got the Coastal Championships.
Yes.
And I think, you know, the real challenge really is for rowing to not just be seen as a 2K race. And we've seen that this year with indoor rowing. I was in Paris last year, just before lockdown, for the indoor rowing championships. We've got coastal and beach sprints. So we are evolving, and it needs to evolve. And a lot of the international federations are small islands and coastal clubs. And Gwyn Batten's been amazing at bringing that on as a GB representation. So we need to innovate. We need to evolve to really still be in that Olympic sport, really.
So both of you have broken barriers in different ways. Sarah, you were first female Henley umpire. Judith, you were the first, I think, non-rowing blue to umpire the boat race.
Yep.
And this year, it's going to be the first time that we've got women umpiring both the women's and the men's boat races. Do you see yourselves as trailblazers? And how important is this?
You go first.
I was talking to someone about this today, and I think it's a bit of an accident of birth, isn't it? It's the time that you're born to be allowed to have these firsts. But it's also about saying yes to something that scares you, or yes, it's something that feels important to you. Trailblazers is not something that sits particularly comfortably with me, because I haven't gone, this is the trail I intend to blaze. I found this path, but it feels quite twisted and turned, and it hasn't been, I'm here and I want to get, you know, to this point. As life happens to you, it's these twists and turns. So I'm really delighted to have the honour of being the first to do things, and not scared by that idea of being a trailblazer, but it certainly isn't a title I sit well or sits easily in me, if that makes sense.
How about you, Judith?
Yeah, well, I remember getting an email from, I think it was one of the umpire community saying, oh, in advance of the women going to the Tideway, Oxford are looking for a woman umpire who's a blue. And I avoided the word last blue. And I thought, yeah. So literally the morning before we were off to, I think it was the Paralympics, because I was launch driving for the Paralympics with my husband, Richard. And we were going to relocate. So I only had like 4 hours time slot in between packing. And I just thought, got to write the email, because it's what I was passionate about. You know, I didn't really think about anything else apart from, yeah, we've been waiting so long for women to get on the Tideway, for women's rowing to be transmitted around the world so women can be inspired by other women. And really, that's my big thing from last year. We weren't able to showcase young women doing sport internationally for other people around the world. But so, like Sarah says, it wasn't really what I set out to do, but it followed my passion, as in it was something I was in the right place, the right time to be part of a journey. And I think it's about being curious, isn't it? It's about stepping up to the challenge that's in front of you and having a go. And in a way, building on all those other women's challenges, whether it's Di Ellis or Annemie Phelps, all those people that spend many years trying to negotiate this way. But also, frankly, I just think the rowing community, I think it's more of an ecosystem of wanting people to succeed, wanting people to have a go, and you put your hand in the ring and you know, well, if people think you know, be any good, they'll pick you, and if not, well, you've given it a go, and there's no shame to that. So yeah, curiosity, passion, and a very small amount of time to send the email in.
I love that.
Didn't talk yourself out of it. I love that, Judith.
Yeah, no time, just go for it.
Yeah, it's that moment when you've pressed send and you're like, oh, I've done it.
Yeah, and actually I was chief umpire, chief umpire for the Fours Head at the time. So frankly speaking, my real focus was, as soon as we got back from the Paralympics, getting organised for the Fours Head. And because, like Sarah, is involved in many other different parts of this ecosystem of rowing, not just umpiring, you get this understanding of what it's all about. And so you think, actually, yeah, I can do that because I've got all these other little building blocks.
Now, you're obviously the first, it's the first time where it's been an all female team doing the umpiring at the boat races. Has there been any resistance to that, or is it the reverse?
Well, I would say it's the reverse. Back in 2012, when Sarah and I came onto the panel, well, I would say there was a wholehearted embracing of us being on the panel and wanting to share the knowledge. I certainly learned a huge amount, not just in knowledge, but in how they do stuff and how they challenge things. So they've been super supportive. And in the early days on the Tideway, we were able to go out and shadow. So from my perspective, it's been brilliant. And actually, the gender thing wasn't really an issue at all.
I think, absolutely endorse what Judith said. And I am utterly grateful for the time that the panel members gave us, their time, their knowledge and their expertise to support us in this journey. There was resistance, I think, for women umpiring the men's races at the beginning. And that was, I think, not because we were women, but it was because we were non-alumni. And I think the non-alumni of that race, it was breaking a huge length of traditions that only alum had done of the men's race, had done that race. And it was really difficult, I think, for some people to let go of that and allow that shift to happen. And I know the year I umpired Isis Goldie, that year, right up towards the race, there were some conversations as whether that was the right thing for us to be doing. And on the day, actually, lightning did strike. So I had a small smile when I saw that happen on the Tideway. Luckily, it was in a safe distance away and we didn't have to make any change. It was a massively challenging day. We know that race, it was the day that the women sunk and the Cambridge women sunk under Barnes Bridge. So it was a really challenging day. But when something's been going on for a certain way for so long, it can be really hard to let go of that tradition for the people who have been involved. That's all they've ever known. So that's where I've noticed the resistance come in, if at all.
Mm. Oh, well, that's really encouraging. So what would you say are the qualities that an umpire needs?
Bravery.
Well,
I think, yeah.
Well, I was thinking about this, and actually I don't think you should prejudge. I think people should have a go at any aspect of event organising or club organisation that takes their fancy, frankly, because how do you know? How do you know whether this is your thing or not? Somebody looked at me 30 years ago and said, oh, you're going to be an umpire. I think not on your nelly. But actually, you as a person, you evolve. And I was trying to think, when is my first bit of race organizing? And I think it was, I was doing a double skull with a girl up at Ancombe, and we had to hand write out start lists and put safety pins in numbers. And that was probably the beginning. And so I would say to anybody sort of interested is actually, don't think about it too much. Have a go, whatever opportunities are there, help out, and then let it evolve and ask questions. So yes, bravery to a degree, but actually it's about understanding those fundamental roles for the umpires. But there's lots of other roles people can be involved in the race. And I guess I really want to take this opportunity to shout out for all those event organisers, including for the boat race, who don't get any visibility, who are, you know, up early laying buoys and stuff, because it is this part of this crazy team. So I'm not going to say what qualities you need to be, because actually there's a variety we need. But Sarah.
Yeah, I say bravery because a bit like a football goalkeeper, a hockey goalkeeper, people are only talking about you as an umpire if things have gone wrong, and you have to be prepared. You have to be prepared to have that conversation. But for me, I think it's about decision making. You know, it's about looking at the athletes and the coaches and all the people that Judy's talked about that have spent so much time, and it's your job to facilitate the race, actually get them to do their best work, and that excites me. Colleagues who trained a long time, we wanted to be more confident, so they actually took up umpiring because they wanted to become more confident and really work on their communication. Now you may ask, you know, you wear a flag and say one or two words, but you do need to be able to communicate with others at a number of times in a really clear and succinct manner. So you gain all sorts of skills from it. And as Judy said, wherever you start, you develop and are developed through doing this work.
Yeah, I can see that communication skills must be massively important, because I've been there in the finish tent at the regatta where there's quite a difference of opinion over what should happen. You know, something's gone wrong and, you know, someone's challenging a result. And actually what makes for the best outcome is often, from my position sort of not being responsible for it, is the way they communicate it. So in a way, that's almost more important than the decision that they make, because if someone goes in and is insensitive with a coach or a junior or a parent or whatever, it's much worse than if they communicate it kind of sensitively and compassionately and clearly as well.
And spot on. And when you're at the start of Marlo Juniors and there's 14, 13 year olds who've never been at a race before, you do all the bits you have to do as an umpire, but you also talk to them in a way that they can understand. So you get this bit of hat, I'm talking to you now. In a minute, not yet, I'm going to say attention, go. And get them to have a good experience, because we've talked about getting this bug, and if we facilitate them in the appropriate way for their level, their standards, so have a good experience, they'll come back whether they win or lose, because it shouldn't be about the result at that stage. You know, if you win, fantastic, but if you haven't, what have you learned? And for me, that's really important. And I think it's also knowing your role, even as a boat race umpire. Whilst Judith and I will be there holding our flags, we have a finish judge. It's up to them to tell us who's won and lost. That's not our role. It's our job to give them fair and safe racing, essentially, and someone else's job to do that bit. So you are working in a team, and you have to be very clear of what your role is and what it isn't, and not get seduced or sucked into doing something that you really don't have the best viewpoint to be part of.
Absolutely. When people know the roles and it all fits in, actually it looks seamless. It is like rowing makes it look easy. And I guess that's the challenge of the umpire, is you won't get noticed really unless something goes wrong. And our ideal would be that actually we set off at the start, we might warn a few times, but then there's no confrontation, no conflict. But if there is a conflict, we have to be decisive, as Sarah says.
Now, there's something I spotted on your LinkedIn, Judith, where you said something about poetry for problem solving.
Oh, yeah.
So I couldn't let the moment pass without actually asking you what that means and whether there's any use for it in umpiring.
Oh, gosh, not thought about whether there's use for umpiring. I'll have to give that a go. Poetry for problem solving. So as an engineer, we sort of try to understand the world, but it's more than science, and put it into practice. And I've often, you know, at school, you have to separate from sciences and arts. And I've recently, as you grow older, you think, what, why is that? What, why didn't I do that? And so a friend sort of shared with me, oh, have a look at this poetry. And I thought, yeah, actually, poetry is like science, but in a different way. You're trying to distill out something and think about it a lot to understand it, and then it can be used a lot. So let's say this water bottle, for example, you know, people have understood all of the materials, but fundamentally it's a water bottle, but that can be used for lots of things. And in a way, what I was fascinated about poetry is to understand language and put it in a form that is almost timeless. And so poetry sort of forces you to really think and observe and try and put in simple words, or in words that could have several meaning. So, you know, I'm a novice at poetry. This is a new thing to me. And I go to a monthly poetry group, would you believe, and try different things. But it was about discovering something I had to drop very early on, because I was rubbish at English language at school. And I felt, actually, maybe I should have spent a bit more time doing it. So the idea of poetry in engineering and science is, because we've split people up at school, how are we missing an opportunity? Are we missing an opportunity that actually, because engineering is actually an art, it's a science and art together, and has our system forced us to not get the most out of people because we siloed them? So that's what I'm exploring. It's very hard because I prepared a session from January poetry group about hydrogen, because with climate change and everything, there's a lot going on to see, can we use hydrogen more to displace fossil fuels? And I thought, this is going to be a big experiment. Can I teach enough about hydrogen and science to my fellow poets, most of whom are linguists and stuff? And can we write some poetry to get people to think and change their thoughts and behaviour? So, hey, you know, the experiment's ongoing. We'll see.
So we want to see some rowing poetry.
Maybe we should. Maybe I'll try and write some after the boat race.
Oh, would you? That would be amazing. I'll get you back on to read it out.
But you know,
I want to hear the hydrogen poem.
Oh, right. Okay. But I think, I know this isn't about the pandemic and everything, but what I really think, we've got a lot to learn from this pandemic, and I think the boat race will talk about it more. But actually, I think it's challenged lots. It's challenged the status quo. And in a way, we have to change hearts and minds. And I think that's what the pandemic's done for me. And poetry helps change hearts and minds, helps communicate to people in a different level. And now we know and understand more about science, then maybe that can help resonate. I don't know. Work in progress. I'll try and write something for the boat race after.
Amazing. That's fantastic. Well, let's actually touch briefly before we go on to the boat race, which we really must get onto. Let's talk a little bit about COVID and where we are with rowing, whether we can draw some benefits from the last year and bring them into rowing. What are your thoughts on this? Do you want to start, Sarah?
Oh, it's been a tough year, hasn't it? And I think one of the things that has really troubled me, and I can't use any other words, is the inequalities that have come out in our society. We've had a chance to observe them in a way, and you know, I don't think we can talk about rowing. You asked earlier, can rowing become one of the major sports? There still are a huge number of barriers for people to get into rowing. The thing that I have really enjoyed seeing is the inventiveness that people have tried to be more inclusive about our events and Women's Head. You know, yes, you could do that with an ergo, and I know you've been a huge part of Zoom ergos, and I've loved watching that, but that's still a big piece of equipment. So how else do you want to do it? How can we just be more fun and more imaginative? And I, for years, have really believed that we should be creating grossly athletic people and then helping them row, not bringing people too early into this rowing world and have them so linear in their behaviours and their movement. And my background was multi-sport, and I came into rowing, and I truly believe that gave me a fast track into this sport. So I think we need to think about the inequalities in society and really think about how we can reach out as much as possible to people, and whether it's rowing they want to do or being active in any other way, being encouraging, and I'll put our arms around them, because there's something about doing exercise and events together that we've really seen. We knew it from physically being together, but we're seeing it from being virtually together. It is not maybe as powerful, but it is equally important to do. So I'd love to see us just getting more inventive and more open with rowing.
Yeah, that was one of the lovely things, actually, in the Women's Head, seeing some people doing just living room circuits. You know, somebody who did squats all the way through, which for 17 minutes and 40 seconds is quite something. Yeah. Yeah, that's a big long sally up. Judith, what are your thoughts on this?
What I really realized is, for me personally, is the mental benefit I get from either rowing or umpiring or attending events. And that camaraderie, really. And the one event I was able to sort of attend was Weybridge Silver Sculls. We managed to umpire at that. And the joy of people rowing, seeing people rowing, and the joy of seeing grannies and their little ones walking on the towpath, it made you realise what this thing called rowing is in the broader sense. So I think what it's given me this year is realizing the real value, the broad value of rowing to both mental and physical health, and that ecosystem, that community of rowing, and whether they're adaptive rowing or corporate rowing or older people that have put on a bit of weight, actually there's so many benefits. And so in all the challenge, and there has been challenge, huge challenge, I really believe that the wonderful ethos of rowing will come out. It really will. And we just have to be a little bit innovative and inventive. And I know the honesty and the connectivity of when it's sort of international athletes doing Zoom ergos, I think that's a really special thing that rowing has as a community that will come out. We and all of us, I'm sure, will help try and help that come out. May have to see things in a different way.
Yeah, it's felt to me like there's been a sort of, particularly like you say with Zoom ergos, when you've got these kind of iconic figures in the rowing world, it's kind of democratized rowing in a way, because, you know, you get chats at the end, you get regular rowers just having a chance to get tips and see these kind of legends in their homes. They're normal people. It sort of strips away the mystique in a way. And you see that they have, you know, this huge work ethic and this talent, but at the same time, they're there chatting away and just kind of being normal people. And I think that's been really wonderful and has kind of connected ordinary club rowers with the elite rowers. You know, they're not kind of hidden away in Caversham, they're right there on our screens, which has been absolutely amazing.
And I think, and I don't have an ergo, so I've not done Zoom ergos, I'm afraid, but I think the thing that's key for me is that it's stepped away, if I understand it, from being competitive and it being about who's pulling the highest score and all this, because there's enough of that in life. Mm-hmm. And there's opportunity for that elsewhere if you want to go and do that. But actually having something where it's inclusive and it doesn't matter what you're pulling and just come and have a go and just work it out, that is so refreshing for me and so important right now. It's not about the result. It's more about the process, what I'm hearing, the conversations, the connections. And,
yeah,
you know, we have to remember that. That's as a child who was part of a rowing club, as a kid, I got taken. And the best bit was you got a ginger beer and a Mars bar, because there was a bar and people went and did their rowing. I didn't care about that, but I knew there was going to be a ginger beer and a Mars bar. There are other chocolate bars out there, but you know, and the rowing club bar, that community was so, so important to people. And I think that's what kept people coming back to rowing clubs. And the community still exists. It's just a little bit more hidden and we've become a little bit more busy potentially. So how do we really connect back into that?
Yeah. Well, we must move on to the boat race, which this year is taking place, in case anyone's missed out on the news, it's taking place in Ely on the Great Ouse, which is also home to the Great Ouse Marathon. It's where Cambridge does their training. And it will be COVID secure and behind closed doors in the sense that people won't be coming along to spectate. But give us a little picture of what you anticipate it will look like. What will we be seeing when we tune in?
Well, first of all, I think the best place to be to watch the boat race will be on the sofa at home. And the BBC, we've seen a little bit of the plans, are going to do an amazing job. So I think definitely enjoy being in a warm, cozy place. The course is obviously shorter than the Tideway. It's relatively straight. There's a slight bend.
How long is it?
I think it's just under 5K. It's basically under 5K because it's between Queen Adelaide Bridge and Littleport Bridge. That's determined it. And early on, we had a conversation with the clubs about the direction. And so it was felt, let's go with the flow. We're in the process with the organising committee, who've done an amazing job, get some state boats there so that we can try and replicate the sort of Tideway distance. But it's a narrower, between 30 and 40 metres across is the river. So it's going to be tighter. There's not going to be the place that we have on the Tideway for crews to go around bends and stuff. Won't be that there. But I think it's possibly more intense. I don't know what Sarah thinks about this, but possibly more intense and therefore more critical for the coxes really to focus in on their race. You know, 5K, it's shorter than the Tideway. We might have some real humdingers of races. We don't know. Sarah, what do you think?
So what you're going to see is clearly a gladiatorial race, side-by-side racing, 5K, coming off a state boat, so there will be a system of that yet to be tested, but we will have tested by race day. We've got a few weeks. And as on the Tideway, as umpires, we will be coming up behind. We're having a liner on the start, and there'll be that moment where I'm sure the BBC are looking at all different camera angles and what they can do, but that moment at the start where everything goes quiet and attention go. I always said the man says go, which is a really funny, but it'll be the woman who says go on this particular occasion. And as Gigi says, it's a tighter course. And if you can imagine the feeling at Henley, if you've raced there, there's not the booms clearly, but it feels a bit like that as an umpire. And clearly both of us have raced at that course. So that'll be really, I think it'll be really exciting. And we both umpired trial eights before Christmas, and they were fantastic races. So I think it'll be fantastic racing. And I'm just really, really looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it for the athletes, because they've had to deal with an extraordinary year of uncertainty. And for any of us who have struggled with COVID, and I'm sure we've all struggled in our different ways, I think it's the uncertainty that I found so challenging. And the days where things feel like they're opening up and everything feels so hopeful, and then they close down and everything feels so bleak. And my thinking has certainly been really emotive about it. And for them to have managed their state and managed to get themselves into the 12 that are training, I know now, and then into the 8 who will compete as in this race, I mean, it's an extraordinary effort. And I desperate for them that they get to race. And I hope that the other athletes who've been part of the sport will get to race later. But it's going to be exciting.
And what would you say are the kind of challenges particular to this course? Because obviously most people who have followed the boat races in the past are familiar. You've got the bends, which give an advantage at one point and then another, and you've got all the landmarks, and you've got the tideway itself, which is an unpredictable beast. So what are they going to be tackling on this stretch of water?
And Patricia, I know you've raced here, so I'm going to ask you that question. What's your perspective?
Well, I was just sitting there in the two seat doing my thing, so you'd need to ask the cox. But I do remember seeing lots of single sculls caught in reeds as we went along. So I would say, depending on what's going on with the flora and fauna, that, you know, you don't want to get too close to the edge. I think what I found most challenging there was just the fact it's quite featureless. Yeah. You know, you don't have much to look at. By the last 5k, you know, we were in pieces anyway, so I don't think it would have really helped having a bandstand and Harrods and you know, Chiswick 8, whatever. But you don't have the bridges to push off, all of that kind of thing.
I think this is where the role of the cox is going to be super important, and for the crew to have their own game plan. So the crews will be going through their preparations now. I think the normal aspects of knowing where they want to be on the river at certain times, the importance of the cox, the importance of having your own race plan, but also then being able to push off the other crew. And in the last years, when we've been on the tideway, we've been able to have fixtures, they've been able to practice against visiting crews. We've not had that. And there may have been some athletes who've carried over, but there's going to be some new athletes. So it's going to be interesting.
What are you preparing yourselves for as the potential things that might happen? Because obviously with the tideway, you'd have, you know, anything can happen and anything has happened. And sometimes it's something that nobody could possibly have predicted. But what are the potential kind of dramas that you're preparing for?
I would say similarly to any rowing race, of course, you know, in an ideal world, the boats will go off, the coxes will get them in good water, and they will have a clean race, and they'll allow the rowers to do their best work. It's a bit like if you're racing in a 2,000 metre course, you've got markers, and you'll talk about those markers. Those markers will exist, and they'll be able to have a race plan off those. I don't know. I don't think I've ever actually seen the bandstand when I'm racing the eight's head or the four's head, or even as a single sculler. You know, you kind of know it's there, but it's this sort of word that happens. You're like, oh, brilliant, we've got there, that's fine, I've lived this long. There is a very small bend at about 2.5K, and what we will be ensuring at that point is the boats have good separation. And of course, this race is under boat race rules, not British rowing rules. So there's just 10 rules of the boat race, and we've had to tweak them very slightly because one of them talks about Hammersmith Bridge and Barnes Bridge, so they're not very useful for this particular thing. But basically, it talks about how the crews need to get onto the start at the right time, how they have to respond to the umpire. So if Judith or I are warning, we're expecting them, I warn, you move, is usually something I will say in the briefing. And we might warn on where they are on the river or on direction, because what we're really intending to do is stop them or discourage them in every way we can from committing what we call a foul. And that's if boats, blades or people, that's the rule, hit each other. And we genuinely don't want to do that, because then the crews are at risk of disqualification. So as we're going down the course, we'll be looking at where they are on the river, the direction they're going, and whether we need to warn them for any reason in that. And what we're really doing is looking to only warn the crews if we're looking to avoid a foul.
Is there a perceived advantage on either station at Ely? Obviously, it's not tried and tested yet, but
we'll see. The races we saw at Trial 8, those who won the task took the railway site on that particular day. So we'll see what happens. Obviously, we're doing everything to ensure that the course is fair.
And what about Cambridge being more familiar with the course? How much of an advantage does it give them? And how much easier does it make it for you as a Cambridge person, Sarah, over Judith as an Oxford person?
I think, interestingly, for those of us who were involved in 2012 in any way, there was a huge project that went along that looked at home advantage versus home disadvantage. So how do you maximise the advantage, which is, you know, the fact that you know the water, you know the area, you feel familiar, against the disadvantage, which is it isn't special, it isn't different, you're not going into someone else's backyard. And so I would say both universities are sitting in one of those camps. Yes, Cambridge know the water, but the water is straight. It's not like a tideway that you get to know the idiosyncrasies and the nuances on it. It's a simpler river system, if you like. There's a couple of outlets, but we're going to work with the local authorities to make sure they're closed on the day so they won't affect the race. So I think it'll be a perceived home advantage, not a real one, potentially. And that excitement of going somewhere new and coming in and it's race day, I know, always gave me a lift, like putting your boat on a trailer, all that sort of process that you get when you are going somewhere to compete. Of course, that Cambridge won't get that. They won't have that. And they may have to think about how they want to create it. And for me personally, it's an advantage. I've rode on that course a couple of times. It certainly hasn't been something that I used often when I was training. It's 25 years this year from one of my boat races. And we did go to Ely at the time. It was quite new for us to be doing that as a women's squad, but we used the other side of the town and actually went in the other direction because at the time we couldn't go on the Adelaide stretch because it didn't help the men win the boat race. So I don't have more umpiring experience particularly than Judith does. We've both been to the course, we've both umpired the course, so I'd say we're on a fairly equal footing on that.
Yes, and actually we managed to get up there, didn't we, Sarah, in December, just when there was that window. And I would say I sort of brought that experience of when I'm going to any new course, what am I looking for? What's the river like? What's the warm-up circulation pattern likely to be like? Are there any obstacles? Where are the landmarks? So in a way, I sort of went back to sort of my normal umpiring event, sort of new river sort of checklist, if you like. And so that's how I saw it. So like Sarah, it's like, okay, we see it as a bit of river rather than think, oh, Sarah's got more familiarity to it than me. And then I think on the coaching side, I think this is where the real skill of the coaches is to help prepare their athletes, whatever the situation. You know, rather than comparing themselves to somebody else, of actually, okay, this is you, I want to get the best out of you. And certainly the Oxford coaches are amazing. They somehow do get more than the sum of the parts of the boat. And I'm sure some of us have had coaches like that, that somehow you perform miracles and you think, how did that whole happen? So different challenges, but the coaches have got such a wealth of experience and knowledge and will bring both the psychological elements into play as well as the physiological elements.
I heard someone saying that the drone footage will look really cool because of you've got the fens on either side and, you know, because it's that bit straighter, you don't have that lovely, that familiar yes. kind of curve of the river, but that it could actually look really quite dramatic and be a great spectator sport as well, even though it's not the usual.
Absolutely. And you know, we have some wonderful rivers in the UK. And part of my poetry reflection on water, I did a session on water last year. And I just thought, gosh, water, you know, has been such a part of my life. And part of the joy of going umpiring in different places around the country when we could travel was to see rivers around the different country, around the world, and nature and those wonderful, unique features. And I'm sure we'll see that. We'll see that for the first time from the footage. I know Ely as a city and all the authorities have been super welcoming, so supportive of us being able to host the event there.
And Ely itself is beautiful, isn't
beautiful.
It?
Beautiful. So, you know, hopefully people will be inspired by something different. And it would be great to put on this British sporting event, frankly.
Now, every year at the time of the boat race, social media is full of people kind of grumbling about it. And, you know, we all know that the boat race has a bit of an image problem. Now, I remember writing a blog post about this a few years ago, trying to explain things like the fact that it's a private match. And yes, other universities do have similar private matches. They just don't get the coverage and all this kind of thing. But the one bit that I stuck on was it the kind of blue chip element. The sponsors are always these kind of big blue chip companies. And someone explained to me that actually it's because you need a huge amount of investment and that isn't going to come from smaller businesses. But explain to me what is involved, why it is that you need these kind of very wealthy companies to come in and sponsor it. Where's that money going and why do we need them?
So I'm definitely not involved in the monetary side of this, but I am aware of how much it costs to close the Tideway on for an event and all the bump in, I think, that goes around that event. It is a big event. It costs a lot of money to do that, to close the roads. And any of us who have run heads would have done that at a smaller level in that way. And just the everything costs money for when you're doing the programs as well. So having the fixtures, making sure that you've got the boats, the umpires' boats to follow, it is an expensive program to put on, as anyone who is, you know, we talked about the barriers for rowing earlier. And I'm curious as well, because I think, you know, with the new sponsorship just being announced, these are people who know the boat race. They know the boat race intimately. And we see this in sports sponsorship quite often, the big sponsors are people who are passionate about their sport and the decision makers of that. So I'm wondering if we've also seen that happening in the past.
What do you think, Judith?
Well, I know this year particularly, the organising committee, if you like, has taken the opportunity of this change to really look at everything and have looked at what are their values, what are their strategic pillars. And, you know, the two things that really struck me, well, three things really, is one is to want to inspire others and to gain this transformative sort of potential of sport, the benefit of sport for all, actually it is for all. And this is the beauty of the BBC, you know, covering it, that anybody around the world with a telly or internet will be able to see this stuff happening. And if I hadn't seen those black and white photos when I was young, I wouldn't have even thought to, oh, well, let's see what all this is about. So that's one thing. And I think also there's a real desire to make it inclusive and engaging. And I definitely think, which Siobhan's very much involved in rowing events in the UK and NAT schools, and very well connected with grassroots rowing. So the people that are organising this race are very well connected with UK rowing and understanding how important it is. And they want to cascade that onto others. And then thirdly, they really want to make this socially and environmentally sustainable. And, you know, things have changed, haven't they, over the last 10 years? Well, certainly they've changed throughout recognition in the time that Sarah and I have been on the panel. And so it's like, yeah, this is the time. This is the time to make these big changes, to make the power of sport able to touch everybody in a really positive way. I don't know whether that answers the question, Patricia, but that's what.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And obviously, Hammersmith Bridge is closed at the moment. I don't know if you have the inside track on what's likely to happen next year, whether the boat race will be happily back on the Tideway and, you know, the bridge will be open.
So, Patricia, maybe if I can just start on this one. Daniel Walker chairs the Tideway panel. So there's a lot of domestic events, domestic regattas that would have been happening over the next 3 months. And they won't happen aside of COVID because the bridge is shut and lots of other challenges. And there's a lot of uncertainty there. So don't know. I guess you can only deal with what's in front of you, can't you? But I do know the impact on, you know, just domestic rowing on the Tideway has been huge last year and will be huge this year. And whole groups of people and clubs on the Tideway are trying to reinvent things to help crews and clubs get back to rowing when we're out of lockdown. So that's the focus, really, I think.
And I think, you know, you talked about the press the boat race sometimes gets, and I think there wouldn't be want to be something where the boat race was expecting to go under Hammersmith Bridge when no one else can in our sport. So my understanding, and I don't have an inside track, I can only tell you what I've heard through conversation, is that the ELE is seen as a one-year only solution. There would be, hopefully, in COVID tideway allowing, a race on the tideway in the future. They're not going to be going under Hammersmith Bridge if no one else can. So we'll have to look at what the course could be and make sure that the athletes are, as and coaches as early as possible, know what they're planning to do. And I'm sure those conversations are happening already, actually, because these things take an awful long time and it's different boroughs. So if the race was going to be moved and a similar distance from Hammersmith Bridge one way or other, for example, I don't know that that's what's going to happen, but if it was going to be that, clearly you'd be needing to have those conversations now.
So is there anything else that we need to know about the boat race or about umpiring? Is there anything I haven't asked that I should have asked?
Well, I would just sort of reinforce that umpiring is just one part of this whole ecosystem of rowing. And I call it an ecosystem because we all thrive off each other. You know, umpires don't have a job if there's no racing. So, yeah, it's really a call out for people when they go back to rowing or are able to get back to places. You know, if people are curious, come and say hello. But also to say thank you to, you know, those club people that are doing stuff, fixing boats, or whether they're sort of doing the tea cake stand at some regatta. You know, everybody just loves this sport and puts effort in. And maybe what I've learned this last year is to just thank people for the little things as they happen. That's my passing word. And the rowing is a sport for anybody and has so many wonderful benefits. But yeah, it's been a real joy to indulge myself in an hour of talking about rowing, really.
I guess for me, I think you don't have to be a rower to become an umpire or be part of a rowing club or events. Many parents come in and because their children have found a passion, found a way into the sport, they then find roles that they can play. And I guess the one thing we haven't talked about is how you become an umpire or what that process is like. And for me, I found it a really open and welcome process. I realised I wanted to become an umpire, and then you start getting taken to events and you read the rules, a lot of rules it felt like at the time, and it was quite hard to get my head around it. And as a rower who had competed domestically and internationally hundreds of times, I realised I had never read the rules of racing. I shouldn't say that. As a rower, I usually knew the circulation pattern sort of and knew who to follow if not, but it was fascinating to start to see the real nuances and complexities of putting an event on. So I had to get my head around that and then start having a go. And it was just brilliant to be able to facilitate that for other rowers. And of course, once you've got your British rowing umpire, if you wanted to go further, there's six-lane racing and world rowing or FISA umpiring, as Judith has done it. So there's levels between levels that you can keep progressing, you can keep stretching yourself. Maybe that's important to know.
Brilliant. Well, thank you both so much. It's been just so lovely to talk about rowing, as you say, and great to hear all about the new format boat race for this year. And we will be watching with huge excitement. I hope that everything goes smoothly on the day for you all, that we get some lovely, clean, exciting racing. So, yeah, good luck with it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, I'm certainly going to be glued to my TV on Sunday, and I certainly feel that the races are in safe hands with Sarah and Judith in charge. I really enjoyed hearing about the plans for this year's races and learning more about the world of umpiring as well. And I'll be interested to hear if any of you have been inspired by them to investigate training as an umpire yourselves. And if you have, please, please let me know. It would be really amazing to find out about that. One thing that I forgot to mention in the interview is that Judith took part in the fantastic Race the Thames event last week. She was in a team made up of Hammersmith officials raising money for London Youth Rowing, which is a fantastic charity that provides opportunities for disadvantaged young people to experience the benefits of rowing through coaching, inclusion, health programs, and mentoring. And I'll put the details in the show notes so you can read all about the amazing work they do and maybe make a donation. So I am off now until May, when I will be back with some fantastic guests and hopefully with renewed energy. Although lots of us are back on the water now, I'm still going to be doing my Zoom Ergos on a Wednesday morning at 7:30, so maybe I will see some of you there. Have a wonderful Easter, and I will see you back here in a few weeks' time. So until then, next stroke, easy oar.